thank you so much for all coming out tonight. We were so, well, I was very nervous about the weather. And I've been talking to everyone here at Thurber House, Anne and everyone, and they promised to do the anti-rain dance, and I guess it worked. Because we had horrible, horrible storms in Dayton last night and this morning, but now it's absolutely beautiful. I was here at Thurber House last fall, I think it was, for the publication celebration, and I love this place, and I'm so honored to get to come back and be a part of this series. So I thank everybody at Thurber House and all of you for being here tonight. And as you said, you know, the series does kind of highlight Ohio writers, and I moved to Dayton in first grade, so I'm not really a native, but I consider myself one. I mean, first grade, that's my entire life. And all three of my novels are set in Ohio. Two are in Dayton, and one is in Cincinnati. I haven't yet written one set in Columbus, but I'm sneaking ever closer. The book that I'm working on right now, there is a reference made to the Columbus Zoo, and the main character went to veterinary school at Ohio State. So there's a few flashback scenes here. So I'm getting closer to a book set here in Columbus. And speaking of things set in Ohio, it's become this point of almost, not really irritation, but kind of mostly amusement. But when I am fortunate enough to get reviewed, frequently someone will ask me, and not Margaret from the Columbus Dispatch, she knew better, but other people from other publications will frequently ask, why did you choose to set your books in Ohio? And there's always this tone to the voice that there's this unspoken question like, why on earth didn't you pick someplace more interesting, or, you know, or opt for some bigger city? And honestly, it's never occurred to me to set them anywhere else. We're always taught as writers to write what you know, but then also, I'm always drawn to social issues. All three of my novels started with a social issue that I really care deeply about. And because a novel is not supposed to just carry a message, it has to be a story, I look for the conflict that'll make the story, I look for the people that would inhabit that conflict and encounter these issues, and those people are right here. They don't have to be from New York or LA or New Orleans or someplace more glamorous. And it's always very funny in the reviews and the descriptions, they'll say things like, in the tranquil suburbs of Ohio, or my favorite was, in the idyllic heartland. As if, you know, and it's so shocking that these issues come up here as if we're all supposed to just be happily milking our cows and tending our fields, and we would never encounter such things. So it's always kind of, it's become a point of me when they ask, I'm like, no, it's never occurred to me. And I kind of feel like I said about New York and LA and New Orleans, we have all those stories, and they're fabulous stories, but we have fabulous stories also. And so, a tiny little point with the books that I hope maybe readers elsewhere pick up on is that we here in the heartland, you know, and I'm always very polite to them because that's kind of a Midwest thing, but we have very rich, complicated lives ourselves. So I will continue setting my books in Ohio. I don't have any plans to change that anytime soon. Although a young adult novel, oh, thanks. A young adult novel I am working on is set partially in Ghana in West Africa, but the other part is in Dayton, so we're still safe. And as I said, I am going to focus tonight on The Kindness of Strangers, which is my third novel. But I do, if you'll indulge me for just a second, I do want to thank HarperCollins publishers greatly, because thanks to them, all three of my books are now back in print and out there and under the same publishing house, which for a writer is a wonderful, wonderful thing. And originally, the first two books were with Warner Books, and they were really afraid of The Kindness of Strangers. It was written second, even though it's now published third. And they kept saying, it's a little too controversial. Maybe it could be your third book. When it was time for the third book, they were afraid of the subject matter, and I'll get to that in a moment. And so I had, even after two books out in the world, it was a struggle to find a home. Several publishing houses turned it down. And so I'm so grateful to HarperCollins for what I consider their bravery in taking it, knowing exactly what to do with it. And as I said, you know, I'm always drawn to social issues. And unfortunately, I don't do this intentionally, but those issues tend to be the ones that reviewers consider dark. Traveling Light is a family drama that deals with AIDS. Two Truths and a Lie is a family drama that deals with alcoholism and addiction. And The Kindness of Strangers is a family drama, and it deals with a topic I'll get to in just a moment. But so that's the reason they were afraid, and I'm so glad that HarperCollins picked it up. And what makes me the happiest about that, and it's kind of a lesson for everybody, I think, in how we live, is that I stuck with it and I kept believing in the book. And even though people kept saying, oh, it's not marketable, write something else. And it finally, when it found its home, it has been the most successful of my books. So I think if we, as writers, as artists, as people, we have to do what we think, what we are passionate about, and not worry about from the outset, is it going to be successful? Is it going to be this? Is it going to be that? If we're pulled to it, we kind of have to follow that dream, even though it's a cliche. So it's very, very affirming that the book has had the success it's had after nearly a decade of trying to find its place in the world. So, and this is part of that affirmation of having a wonderful crowd like this. So thank you. So the reason it was so controversial is apparent as soon as you begin to describe what the book is about, plot-wise. Now, this is just plot. But as soon as someone says, what's the book about? And I'll say, well, this is one family's experience being an emergency foster care placement for a sexually abused boy from their community. And right there, you see it on people's faces. As soon as you say sexual abuse, especially involving a child, you see the drawing away. And the sentence isn't over, though. There's a breath there while everybody flinches. And I say, and it's the story of how this family, the foster family, in reaching out to help this boy, end up healing and mending the places in their own family that they hadn't even realized were broken. And it's not a book about child sexual abuse, but you can't really describe it honestly and responsibly without mentioning that. But I want to assure you, it's not about that. Thematically, it's really a book about healing and resilience and the strength of a healthy, safe family's love to carry you through the dark times. And I wasn't interested in writing a book about horrible things happening to a child any more than I assume any of you are interested in reading about that. What I was interested in is what happens when something like that is discovered. What happens next? I was interested in resilience. That's the word I wrote above my computer through the whole writing of the novel. And the abuse is over when the book begins. The kind of inciting incident for the story is the discovery of the abuse. And from that point on, you know, there are no scenes of the abuse or anything like that. But it's a tough sell. And I understand that it's a tough sell. And so, again, it's just such an affirmation for it to be out there in the world. And what I thought I would do tonight is read two passages from the book to kind of give you a taste of it. And then after that, my very, very favorite part of any event is always the question and answers. And I'd be happy to answer questions about this book, about the other two, about writing in general, anything you might be interested in. That's always the part I enjoy the most. But what I thought I'd do is start with the very opening of the novel that doesn't need any explanation. And I just saw the wonderful job they did in the Columbus Dispatch, and that this section is kind of mentioned there. This was one of the last things written. It's kind of a bookend. And I'll read it first and then I'll talk about it. So I'll just start. So if you were to open this book, this is the very first thing that you would see. And am I okay with the mic? Everyone can hear? Well, until this moment. And it's simply labeled Danny. Danny wondered if people looked at his family and knew. Did it show? Sitting there in his childhood home, hours before the wedding, he was astounded they'd all come so far. He looked back and remembered a time he'd never dreamed there'd be a scene like this. He wondered if anyone else looked at them and still thought, my God, it's amazing. He knew that his family still thought it, and that's what he loved about them. On days like this one, or on their graduations or holidays, they sometimes caught one another's eyes, and it was there, the sparkle of we did it, didn't we? This light of how lucky they were. Danny loved the days when they remembered that. Because they didn't always. They couldn't. He knew that it went against human nature to truly savor every moment and continually remain aware of all they had to be grateful for. They couldn't live like that. They'd never get anything done. There wasn't always time to savor every damn little thing like electricity or your car starting or the shipment of specialty cheeses arriving on time. He thought about how much effort and energy it would consume to perpetually relish everything. It wasn't practical, but he thought his family did it more than most, and with good reason. His favorite days were when he knew they were all doing it at the same time. The bustle here in his mother's kitchen gave him a rush. Mom looked great, but he was careful not to tell her too many times. He'd finally convinced her to color her gray hairs, and he didn't want to make too big a deal out of being so obviously right. He just grinned every time someone else told her, "You look fabulous, Sarah." Danny had already taken off his tux jacket and tucked a cloth napkin into his shirt as an apron. He envied how Mom could stir up the brown sugar frosting and never get a drop or splatter on her ivory dress. It was so like her to make the cake herself. Danny had told her he would do it. She had a ton of other things to worry about today, but as usual, she tried to do everything. At least she was letting them all help, even though that added to the chaos. She'd embraced the frantic quality of the day and turned it into a party instead of a hassle. She caught his eye and laughed, then dipped her finger into the melted butter and brown sugar she stirred. She closed her eyes to express her approval. Danny's brothers stood nearby, looking like movie stars in their tuxes, eating the scraps of the buttermilk chocolate cake Danny had trimmed off. They laughed at something, and Danny tilted his head and studied them. His brothers looked as different as two members of a family could look. Most of the time, Danny forgot to remember, but today that was impossible. Odd things brought it all back to him. Sometimes the triggers were obvious, but occasionally they surprised him. The scent of a swimming pool, the sight of a flowering dogwood, a glimpse of a black and white cat, the sound of his laser printer, police in uniform, or a blonde woman wearing pink. Today, it was everyone taking pictures. The flashes and the video cameras reminded him. They always had since the discovery on that rainy, cold day 12 years ago. 12 years. Sometimes the memory seemed so recent it could still make the panic thicken in Danny's chest. Other times it was difficult for the man he was now to recognize the boy he had been then. But Danny couldn't pose for a picture or have someone film him without remembering it all. Danny didn't believe that everything happened for a reason. He refused to believe it. He hated that image of a god, of a world. Too many things were just petty and mean if he looked at them that way. But in college, he'd studied a bit about reincarnation in a comparative religions class. Some people who believed in reincarnation thought there was a place somewhere, a place they couldn't ever recognize in this world, from which they chose the path of their lives on Earth. Danny pondered that when he encountered certain people or contemplated his family's history. If it were true, what made some people choose a remedial cush life and others choose an advanced placement course? What would have made his family choose the shock, the betrayal, the heartache? He wished he understood it. On days like this, he felt he got a little closer. Knowing everything he knew now, seeing how it had turned out so far from this better place, he thought he'd choose this life again. He really thought he would. "Ready with the raspberry?" Mom asked. Danny opened the raspberry preserves he'd canned himself. He spread the preserves between the three layers of dense chocolate cake. When served with homemade vanilla ice cream, this cake was, as Mom called it, just about as close to culinary ecstasy as is possible. This cake had been his father's favorite, and so it touched Danny that it had been requested for today. Thinking about his dad reminded Danny of a family story, an old one, one that used to be told at all the weddings, the Thanksgivings, the bar mitzvahs, and the birthdays. Always on Danny's birthday, at Danny's expense. Before, back before Dad had died, Danny was embarrassed when the story was told, but now he sometimes asked his mom to tell it. He'd been very small, 4, maybe 5, and he'd been playing by himself in the backyard of this very house. Mom and Dad loved to tell how Danny came running into the house and shouted, "Did you know that when you jump, both your feet come off the ground?" Everyone thought it was so cute and dumb, but really, to Danny, it had been a scary moment and an amazing realization. He had seen his shadow against the garage. He had jumped into the air and had seen the space between his body and the grass. Against the white wall of the garage, he saw himself floating, not connected to anything. What kept you from floating away? Dad had told him about gravity, but it was Mom who listened to Danny explain his fear and who hugged him and said, "I'll keep you from floating away. There's a connection between us. Even though you can't see it, you'll always be connected to us." When Danny used to think about his father dead, he sometimes thought of a shadow floating. Dad was like Danny's own shadow. Danny couldn't really touch it, and it was sometimes really hard to see, but it was always there. Danny knew it. He couldn't lose it. And that was family. That was the feeling of safety. And so even though he used to be embarrassed when they told that story, now he liked it. That story was a connection too. It connected everyone who told it to each other. But that story was from before. There were new stories, the stories of after, and the story of how before became after, the story of how they became who they were now. And then it goes into chapter one, and at that point we go back the 12 years, and the heart of the novel, except for that opening and the very closing, is the 12 years in the past of the incident that Danny's referring to, of this summer that made them the people that they are now. And at that point, the novel begins to alternate between three point of view characters besides Danny. The next one that we'll go into is Sarah, Danny's mother. And then you have Jordan, the abused boy, and Nate, who is Danny's older brother, Sarah's other son. And the novel kind of alternates between those three, not always in exact order. And then at the very, very end, it returns to Danny. And as I said, this was... this is described a little bit in the Columbus Dispatch today. Those two bookends from Danny were the very last things written, and they were my editor's idea, and at first I resisted, and I'm really glad I listened to her. She thought because of the subject matter, even though Harper was totally willing to go with this, and they knew what to do, they weren't afraid, you know, to know how to market this. She's like, it's, you know, it is a tough sell. People are nervous. The book's going to take you to some dark places. And the way she described it was, it's a promise extended to the reader that things will be okay. Not necessarily happily ever after, not completely tied up, but they're okay. And you know, when I resisted, I said, this is why I don't like to write sequels. I don't want everything all tidied up like that. She's like, go back and look at the beginning of the Poisonwood Bible. Go back and look at the beginning of One True Thing by Anna Quinlan. So I did, and I really mulled it, and she was absolutely right. And lots, you know, and it's a total device, but it's a good one. And I'm really glad that you know, she didn't tell me which character to use or what the event should be, you know, picking the wedding. But I've had so many readers contact me and say, you know, I got to page 100 and I had to go back and read that opening. And then when I read that opening, I was like, okay, I can keep reading. So I'm so glad that I took her advice. And I've been very fortunate to work with some very talented, good editors. So I'm going to go into the closing of chapter one, which is Sarah. But it's now we're 12 years in the past. And then, like I said, after that section, is the question answers my very favorite. But what you need to know at this point, because we're going to skip a little of chapter one, Sarah is a chef, and I love food, so I was very happy with this food here tonight. Those were amazing brownies. And I'm very, very proud of myself because I was so afraid I was going to end up wearing the mustard for sure, and I didn't. So I'm very, very pleased. But Sarah's a chef, and she used to have a catering business that she operated that she closed when her husband died. She is now a widow. At this point in the story, her husband's been dead for 2 years. He was a doctor, and she now has a catering business that she operates out of her home that she's just started up again. And she has just gone shopping for a book club lunch that she's going to cater that day. How wonderful would that be to have book clubs that catered lunches every month? And she's on her way back from grocery shopping, and it's a typical Ohio April morning. It's pouring rain, it's really raw and cold, and it's been raining for days. And she sees this boy, Jordan, walking down his driveway, and Jordan happens to be her son, Danny's best friend. They're in fifth grade, and these two boys are best friends, and she happens to be best friends with Jordan's mom, Courtney, who is a doctor who used to work with Sarah's husband, Roy. And the family has... In these 2 years since the father died, they've really been struggling. The two boys are in different kinds of trouble. Nate's, the older son, is kind of a delinquent, and Danny is really in academic trouble. He's just really struggling at school. So where this picks up, and I'll read to the end of chapter one. Sarah's driving along after the grocery shopping, and she sees Danny. Yes, I'm sorry, she sees Jordan. Thank you, Mom. Jordan, not Danny. Danny's at school. She sees Jordan. Thank you. See, I'm so glad I brought her here tonight. Okay, cool. Thank you, thank you. I was thinking about that brownie and I got all distracted. Okay, The rain poured heavy as a waterfall, and Sarah knew that Jordan was more than an hour late to school. She pulled her van into the driveway beside him, and Jordan stopped walking and stared at her. He carried his green backpack in front of him, his arms crossed over it against his chest, as if he expected someone might snatch it from him. The rain matted his blonde hair to his forehead. Sarah rolled down her window. "What are you doing out here?" Jordan looked at her and said, "Walking to school," as if she were an idiot. "Where's your mom?" "At work." "An OBGYN, Courtney worked in a private practice as well as at Miami Valley Hospital, the same hospital where Roy had worked." Sarah frowned. She knew that Courtney drove Jordan to school every morning. "Well, is this good timing or what then? Get in, I'll take you." But he stood there as if uncertain. Water ran over Jordan's face, beading in his lashes. It ran off his earlobes and fingertips and the bottom hem of his blue parka, but he didn't move. The wind shifted, and rain poured in the van window, soaking her sleeve. "Come on, get in." Jordan walked around to the passenger side. He put his book bag on the van floor and climbed in. "Is your dad at work too?" He nodded. "Why are you so late for school?" Jordan shrugged and looked out the window. "I fell back asleep." "Your mom left you alone?" "She was on call. She had an emergency." "Well, we'll get you there." Reaching behind her, Sarah pulled a white cotton tablecloth out of the pile she'd packed for the lunch. "Here, dry off." He took it from her, and she backed out of the drive. For a moment, he just held the tablecloth, then he wiped his face and pulled it around him as if cold. Looking at him, draped in white like that, Sarah remembered that kids at school mockingly called Jordan the angel, partly because he was so obviously the teacher's pet, but mainly because of an incident she'd witnessed at the choir concert rehearsal. She'd been standing with Danny's class, lined up in the gym, waiting their turn to go on stage and practice. They watched the fourth graders sing Silent Night, and the lights changed to reveal a tableau of little girls dressed as angels. Jordan, standing at her elbow, had said, "I wish I were an angel." He had a way of blurting out the most bizarre statements to no one in particular, and half the time, Sarah thought he didn't mean to speak aloud. She was certain he hadn't meant to that time, as he startled and blushed at the derisive laughter from the kids in earshot. Here in the van, Jordan sighed. She looked over at him. He closed his eyes and leaned his head back. "Are you okay? Are you sick?" She reached over and touched his forehead. In the second before he rolled his head away from her reach, oven-like heat met her fingertips. "You're burning up. You are sick." Jordan thrust the tablecloth from him and sat up straight. "Pull in here," he said with urgency, nodding to a gas station at the intersection ahead. "I need to go to the bathroom." "Sure." She glanced at him. Was he going to throw up? The van bucked across the uneven gravel lot of the tiny station. Jordan grasped the dashboard, his face white. "Oh, no, they're closed, but we can—" "There's a porta-john," Jordan said, pointing. "Oh, no, hon, you don't want to go in there." But he was already opening his door. "Jordan, they're so dirty. Can you hang on a few more minutes? I'll get you to a cleaner bathroom." He slid out the door, knees buckling as his feet hit the ground. He picked up his backpack, then hesitated. He looked at the porta-john, then at Sarah, and carefully put the bag back on the floor. "You need any help?" she asked, but he shook his head. He bit his lip, looked at his pack, then slammed the door. He weaved his way to the porta-john and disappeared inside it. Sarah pulled up the hood of her rain jacket and followed him. "I'm right outside," she called, feeling helpless. She wanted to go inside with him, but God knows what she'd be able to do to help him, and there'd hardly be room for two. Poor kid. How hideous to be sick inside one of those gross places. She wondered if diarrhea, not vomiting, threatened, because if it were vomiting, she knew she'd rather just do it out here in the parking lot. When the wind blew the rain sideways against her, she walked under the shelter of the gas station's overhang. A wiry brown and white terrier emerged from under a bench near the front door and wagged its stump of a tail at her. She scratched it behind the ears, keeping an anxious eye on the porta-john. Jordan was too sick to go to school. Sarah would take him to her house and call Courtney, glad to do this favor for her friend. What had happened that Courtney had rushed off and left him alone, so obviously ill? That wasn't like Courtney at all. She usually seemed an almost overprotective mother. Everyone understood her worries when they met Jordan. So small, so shy, a loner who shunned the other kids' prompted efforts to include him. Most of the adults found him likable in his oddball way. He was smart and a voracious reader, often lost, it seemed, in his own internal world. He'd won the school spelling bee every year that he'd been here. Sarah had seen Courtney just last night. They'd treated themselves and had made arrangements to go child-free to El Masan, their favorite restaurant. They'd talked for about 2 hours, but Courtney hadn't mentioned anything about Jordan's being sick. Now Sarah looked across the gas station parking lot and tried to will Jordan out of the Port-a-John. What was taking the poor kid so long? As if it read her mind, the little terrier trotted through the rain to the blue plastic hut. The dog sniffed at the bottom of the door. Sarah stepped back into the rain. "You doing okay?" she yelled, banging on the John door. "Jordan, are you all right?" She hesitated, but decided she was a mom after all. If she saw private parts of him exposed, it was no big deal. She pulled open the door and stood staring, not comprehending for a moment what she saw. Jordan sat on the floor, his body facing her, with his knees up sharp by his shoulders. His head lolled to one side, hair touching that filthy seat. Sarah filed away every detail in slow motion. His eyes rolled back white in his head, the puff of gray foam on his chin dripping into his lap, the crotch of his jeans dark, a pool of urine under him. She looked up at his face again, finally seeing it, the needle in his neck. A thin line of blood dripped from the hypodermic jutting out of his throat. The terrier barked and jolted her into action. "Oh my God, Jordan!" She shook his shoulders and a small glass vial rolled from the crook of his hip to the floor. She snatched it up, a trace of clear liquid rolled in the vial. "Jordan, what is this? What did you do?" She shook him again and the needle bobbed. Without thinking, she jerked it out, but her stomach somersaulted when she saw the drops of blood that blossomed and dripped down his neck in rhythm with his pulse. She shoved the vial into her coat pocket before reaching under his arms and hauling him out of the John. Her adrenaline was too much, and Jordan much slighter than she expected, so she barreled out of the Port-a-John and fell. Jordan ended up on his back, looking up at the rain, mouth open, hands unnaturally bent, fingers fluttering. Sarah scooped him up and carried him to the van, the terrier yapping at her heels. She opened the side door and shoveled Jordan in among the plastic bags of wrapped fish and shrimp, then grabbed her cell phone and dialed 911. She realized she couldn't describe where she was. She had no idea what side street she was on, and no name identified the gas station. Never mind. She slammed shut the van door and ran around to the driver's side. "I'll bring him to Miami Valley. Can you tell the ER?" Sarah tossed the phone into the passenger seat before the dispatcher finished speaking. "Jordan! Jordan!" she screamed as she peeled out of the gravel lot and careened through the rainy streets. "Don't die! Don't die! Please don't die! Jordan, talk to me!" As if in answer, more vomit gurgled out of his throat. In the hurried glimpses over her shoulder, she saw he was twitching, convulsing. But as long as she heard his ragged breaths, she could drive instead of performing CPR. She kept repeating his name until she pulled into the emergency room lot, almost hitting the entrance doors. Throwing the van into park, its windshield wipers still flapping, she yanked open the side door and pulled Jordan out by the ankles until she could reach under his arms. She half dragged him through the double set of doors into the registration area, where three people she recognized rushed to meet her, calling her by name. "Is it Danny?" Nancy re-asked as she and an orderly took the child from Sarah's arms and put him on a waiting gurney. "No, no, he isn't mine. His name is Jordan Kendrick, Courtney Kendrick's son. She's a doctor here, obstetrics. I think she's here now." The receptionist bolted for the phone. Nancy was already rushing Jordan away, announcing, "This kid's in cardiac arrest." Sarah reached into her pocket for the vial. "He took drugs. Here, he took this." A nurse snatched the vial from her and ran after Nancy. A male nurse led Sarah to a chair and said, "Give me your keys, Sarah. I'll park your van." She handed over the keys without speaking, wishing that she hadn't needed to see his name tag to remember that his name was Alan. It had been 2 years since she'd set foot here, where Roy had worked and where she'd had to bring him at the unexpected end. The receptionist announced, "Dr. Kendrick's on her way down." The police arrived first, though, and pulled Sarah into an empty exam room and asked her to describe what had happened. She told them and then was free to go. Knowing that she'd missed Courtney's arrival while she talked to the police, she sought out Alan, who told her Jordan had gone into a second cardiac arrest, which they were working on now. He told her Courtney couldn't see her right then. By the time Sarah reached home, there was a sobbing message on the answering machine. "Please don't tell anyone. Please don't talk about this. Sarah, please." She shuddered at the hysteria in Courtney's voice. There was a pause, then a thump, as if Courtney dropped the phone. Hospital paging codes sounded in the background. When she spoke again, her tone had changed. Collected and soothing as if she thought Sarah were the hysterical one, Courtney said, "I ask for your discretion, Sarah. I'm sure you understand. We'll handle this. Everything will be just fine," and hung up. It wasn't until much later in the day, removing the ruined seafood from the van, that Sarah noticed Jordan's green book bag still on the floor of her van's front seat. Thank you.